Dodonna poured damage down onto Centerpoint Station, digging a latitudinal trench of melted metal and scoring to match the longitudinal one Blue Diver had gouged. But the pursuing Bothan and Corellian starfighters, unchecked by a sufficient starfighter screen, continued to hammer away at the battle carrier. Blue Diver broke away from the station to follow the flagship, using her batteries to eliminate as much of the starfighter pursuit as she could. But it was like a novice Jedi trying to protect a haunch of blood-warm meat from a swarm of piranha beetles. Finally, Dodonna jumped, joined shortly thereafter by Blue Diver and the hyperdrive-equipped starfighter supporting them. Anakin Solo was the last to enter hyperspace. Arriving at Point Bleak, the three capital ships maneuvered close to one another, the better to exchange aid and support with overlapping fields of heavy weapons fire. But no enemy vessels followed them out of hyperspace. They had time to assess damage, to communicate with Coruscant, to gather data. It wasn't long before the holonet churned with news reports from Corellia. Prime Minister Durgedjian almost glowed with the victory of casting free the yoke of Galactic Alliance oppression, and offered praise to the forces of Bothawee and Commonor, and to his own battle coordinator, Admiral Delphin, who was conspicuously commended for doing what Admiral Antilles could not, as if she'd had any role in bringing the Bothans and Kaminoans to the table. Admiral Nyathal ordered Dodonna back to Coruscant. She ordered Limpan's task force to effect repairs, stand by, and use its resources to monitor activity within the Corellian system. She also warned Limpan of possible treachery or sabotage. It was clear that the Bothan fleet's departure from the Bothawee system had been kept secret, owing to some catastrophic failure of the Alliance forces monitoring that system. Within a day, the Galactic Alliance declared that the state of war previously enacted against Corellia now extended to Bothawee and Commonor as well. Holonews political analysts, sober or gleeful depending on the political and exploitative leanings of their own news services, speculated on which systems would be next to join what they now referred to as the Corellian Confederation. Commendations were offered on both sides. Memorial services for the dead took place. And with the political climate changed, with a negotiated peace between an isolated Corellia and the Alliance no longer possible, Jason Solo and the Anakin Solo were ordered back to Coruscant.
Zyost.
From high orbit, the world of Zyost didn't look like a place of evil. It was a typical blue-green world, a good mix of landmass and open water, ice at the poles, white cloud formations everywhere, including the characteristic spiral of a hurricane over one of the oceans. The landmasses at the equator seemed to be almost entirely green, graduating to green-white up through the temperate zones and turning to pure white soon after, giving the world large polar ice caps. There was no hint of desert or any terrain other than forest and tundra. It was, in fact, a beautiful place, if one looked only with one's eyes. But Ben had other senses, and through the Force, he could feel something else, something malevolent about the planet. It seemed to be staring at him, as if it were a mottled eye, belonging to a hideous, hate-filled face he couldn't quite make out. Ben stared at Zyost, and Zyost stared at Ben. Ben gulped.
Shaker, do you pick up any thruster trails?
Ben asked the R2 unit that came with the Y-Wing starfighter he had appropriated. The astromech tweeted an affirmative noise, and lines of text popped up on one of the Y-Wing's cockpit displays. Heavy orbital trail indicates one or more vehicles in specific orbit for considerable time. Vehicles left orbit approximately 8 standard hours ago and made planetary descent. The cockpit sensor display switched from a live sensor feed to a diagram of the planet's surface, with dotted lines showing the abandoned orbit and the descent path. Ben felt a wash of relief. Of course, Zyost was a dead world in terms of planetary civilization. Few vehicles ever arrived here, and thruster trails would be distinct for a long time. That changed the prospect of finding a single vehicle in an area the size of a planetary surface from crazy to possible. He switched the R2 unit's data over to his navigation computer and plotted his own descent. From an altitude of a few kilometers, traveling slowly enough that the Y-Wing would neither cause sonic booms nor pull contrails visible from the ground, Ben studied the vehicle that must have brought Faskus back to Zyost. It was a Corellian YT-2400 light transport, disc-shaped, like Uncle Han's venerable Millennium Falcon, but with its cockpit at the end of a starboard side outrigger-style projection. At least it had once been a YT-2400. Now it was a scorched heap of buckled durasteel, blackened in numerous places by fire, smoke still curled up into the sky from spots where the hull had ruptured. The cockpit and its access tube had separated from the transport's main body and had rolled, or been hurled, down a gentle incline, putting them 20 meters from the main hull. A light snowfall drifted down across the two main portions of the destroyed craft. Had it crash-landed? Ben increased the magnification on his visual display and shook his head. No. The scorch patterns on portions of the hull showed clear sign of turbo laser strafing. The transport had been fired upon multiple times and then had burned. Ben quickly switched back to primary sensors, but there was no sign of other air traffic in this area. The attacker was long gone. Ben spiraled down to a landing in the same clearing Faskus had chosen. He set the Y-wing down well clear of the burned wreckage, then investigated on foot. Portions of the transport were cool enough to approach, and he was even able to enter one or two places where hatches had been blown off or the hull had gaped open wide enough to admit him. There was nothing within but lingering smoke and the smell of burned plastics and pseudo-leathers. Seeking more clues, he opened himself up to the Force and shivered. The sensation of being stared at was stronger here than it had been in orbit. And then he felt it, just at the periphery of his Force senses, a little hint of wicked glee, just as he'd felt it at the display case on Drua. Heading westward, the direction in which Ben felt the distant glee, he and Shaker plunged into the forest of Zyost. It was a cold day. Though Ben had felt comfortable out in the clearing, in the cloud-muted sunlight, here the forest canopy cut off most of the sunlight, and Ben felt a chill. The massive, dark, twisting tree trunks, looking like pain-racked bodies, flash-frozen and preserved in their agonies, added to his unease. He pulled his Jedi cloak from his backpack and donned it, grateful for both its warmth and the symbolic protection it offered. There were no trails through this forest, just dense undergrowth. Shaker's limitations in the environment, the droid could move briskly on its wheels on flat, hard surfaces, but had to waddle slowly on legs on uneven terrain, kept their progress slow. But in the first hour of travel, Ben did not feel the glee he was pursuing become more distant. If anything, he and Shaker seemed to be closing very slowly on his quarry. Then he heard sounds from the direction they'd come. The sounds were far away, muffled by distance in the oppressive forest, but Ben thought he recognized the scream of ion engines, the thoom of laser fire. Shaker began tweedling a complicated message. With a sinking feeling, Ben pulled out his data pad and opened it. A series of diagnostic reports scrolled by on the screen too fast to read, but then the message scrolled to a stop. The last line read, Y-wing diagnostic summary. Assessed damage precludes functioning. Communications ended. Probability 84% that Y-wing has been totally destroyed. Ben sank down to sit on the powdery snow cover on the forest floor. Faskus's enemies had come back and destroyed his transportation, the only way he knew to get back off-world. The files he had suggested that no one was sure of any sentient beings still left on Zyost. There might not be anyone to help him get off-world, ever. And no one who cared about him knew he was here. He was going to die alone on Zyost. He forced himself to stiffen up. Whether he died or not, he had a mission to finish. And once it was done, he had a second mission, a personal one, to punish the people who had tried to exile him on this lonely world. Ben spent a cold night. In the first part of the night, he found a low, hollow spot where the wind couldn't reach him. He rolled up tight in his Jedi robe and fell almost instantly asleep. Then 2 hours later, he woke up, so cold that it was his own body shaking that had jarred him from sleep. He was also blind, or so he thought, unable to see Shaker less than a meter away. But when his cold, stiffened hand was able to extract a glow rod from his pocket and ignite it, he realized that he was surrounded by fog. Together, he and Shaker clambered their way out of the hollow, and he found that the temperature rose by several degrees as they ascended the slope. Toward the top, he used his lightsaber to cut dead branches from some of the trees. With them and leaves, he built a fire, igniting it with his lightsaber. After a few minutes of warming himself, he made a sort of nest out of snow and more leaves. Only then did he allow himself to fall asleep again. The cold awoke him several times during the night, and once, distant screams, like a primate being tortured, jarred him from his rest. Each time he was able to doze off again, though it was to formless dreams in which dark shapes crawled close to his sleeping body and whispered into his ear in a language he did not know. By morning, he was slightly more rested, but he would have traded a month's service to a hut refresher cleaning firm in exchange for a tent and a portable heater. Once the sun was up high enough to provide some sparse heat to his surroundings, he and Shaker set out again. He could still feel the distant glee. At mid-morning, he ran out of the food he had bought himself on Drua.
"I don't suppose you have anything stored in that inner compartment?"
he asked Shaker.
"Know anything about hunting? I mean, I'm not asking you to hunt. I was just wondering if you had any texts on hunting. Something I could read to learn how."
The R2 unit lurched forward, waddling faster. They were now at the edge of a large, snow-filled clearing, and Shaker moved into that open space. Following, Ben saw the reason for the Astromech's agitation. In the distance, beyond the next verge of trees, a plume of smoke rose into the sky. Someone had built a fire, and that beacon was in exactly the same direction as the sense of glee Ben sought. An hour later, they were at the edge of another clearing, looking at a camp. There was a tent, improvised from several bright red emergency blankets and yellow cord. There was a fire, as paltry as Ben's own from the previous night. There was an enormous backpack rigged from an oversized carry sack, a few Durasteel spars doubtless salvaged from the downed YT-2400, and more yellow cord. And there was a man. Leaving Shaker behind, Ben crept forward, keeping low behind snow mounds. When he was close enough to get a good look at the man, he felt a sense of disappointment. Faskus of Zios didn't look much like a protector of Sith artifacts. He was a pale-skinned human, with a chin that was just two steps short of being adequate and a thick, curling black mustache that only emphasized his chin's inadequacy. He wore gray garments that were the height of anonymity. He moved slowly, adding branches to his fire, and talked to himself, words that Ben could not hear. And the first time he turned in Ben's direction to add another handful of sticks to the fire, Ben could see that he wore the amulet of Kalara on its chain around his neck. Ben froze. If Faskus knew he was here, the man could vanish from his perceptions, could track him down and kill him with little effort. Ben had to obtain the amulet without alerting Faskus, and that meant waiting for an opportunity. No, Ben was hungry now, and would only get hungrier and colder, exercise being counterproductive when an agent was trying to remain undetected. If he waited, he would either become so weak and stiff that he could not complete his mission, or he would freeze to death. So the situation meant that he would have to attack, and attack soon, and attack without mercy. Anyone who could steal the amulet and wield its power had to be formidable. When Faskus turned his back again, still mumbling to himself, Ben crept closer. He could hear some of Faskus's words.
"Worry at all. Got to be shelter. Not bad as it looks."
Ben rose up to peek over the edge of the depression. Faskus had his back to him again. Ben sprang forward, shoving himself through the force, giving his leap extra distance, extra altitude. In the middle of his arc, he brought up his lightsaber. As he began his descent, he ignited it. The sound alerted Faskus, who began to turn. And in the final quarter second before impact, Ben saw, beyond Faskus, sitting on blankets at the front of the tent, staring up at him with wondering eyes, a little girl. He was going to cut off the man's head in front of this little girl. Ben landed foot first, kicking Faskus back across the girl, landing astride the man. He heard Faskus's grunt of pain, heard the girl's muffled shriek. Ben's lightsaber cut into the tent's top blanket, setting the edges afire. He shut the weapon off. Then he got his free hand on the amulet and yanked. The chain didn't give way, and neither did Faskus's neck. Ben swore and yanked up, drawing the chain free of its wearer. Only then did he retreat, scrambling backward from the tent mouth, and drop the amulet into his pouch. The little girl squeezed herself out from beneath Faskus's legs and looked around wild-eyed. She had dark hair, cut short, and blue eyes. She might have been 6 standard years old, and she wore a garment that was a child's copy of an orange X-wing jumpsuit. When she caught sight of Ben, she shrieked again.
"Shut up!"
Ben said. The girl hurled herself on Faskus.
"Daddy! Wake up, Daddy!"
Ben looked at Faskus. The man was unconscious. Odd, since Ben didn't think he'd hit him that hard. But that would help. Ben returned his lightsaber to his belt, then patted Faskus down. The blaster in Faskus's belt holster was real. So were the smaller ones in his boot and in the small holster under his right sleeve. So was the vibroblade in the sheath in his left sleeve. Ben appropriated all the weapons, then looked around. There was a coil of yellow cord in one corner of the tent. Ben snatched it up. Then he rolled Faskus over, discovering and appropriating another blaster in a holster at the base of his spine, and got to work tying his hands.
"You're hurting him!"
"No, I'm not. I'm just tying him up."
"He's already hurt! You're making it worse!"
Ben finished with Faskus's hands and got to work on the man's feet.
"Where?"
"His stomach!"
Ben rolled Faskus over again and pulled up the man's gray tunic. He whistled. An improvised bandage, thick layers of shirt cloth held on by bindings made from torn cloth strips, covered the lower left portion of Faskus's stomach. It was soaked with blood. Carefully, Ben untied the strips and lifted the bandage free. A look at the blood-washed skin beneath showed him that Faskus had suffered a penetrating wound at least 7 centimeters long. More blood welled from it as the bandage came away. Faskus groaned, but did not wake up. Ben replaced and retied the cloth. He'd received training in first aid from both his Jedi teachers and the guard, but more than first aid was called for here. He put his hands on Faskus's chest and brow and sought what knowledge and feelings he could through the Force. He didn't know much about Force healing, but Master Silgall and his father had taught him a few things, bare necessities. Faskus was not strong in the Force, not strongly here. He was like a flickering candle compared with his daughter. There was turbulence from the wound. As Ben peered deeper, he sensed blood flowing where it should not. He sensed life ebbing. He didn't know much about stomach wounds. Other Jedi had told him they sometimes didn't bleed much, but that they usually hurt a lot. Faskus should be dead now, and it was clear that only willpower and a desire to protect his daughter were keeping him alive. And even they wouldn't be enough for long. Ben hesitated, wondering how to tell the girl.
"What's your name?"
he asked.
"Kiara, are you going to make him better?"
"I can't."
Faskus's eyes opened.
"Who are you?"
he asked.
"Ben Skywalker, Galactic Alliance Guard."
"Any relation to Luke Skywalker?"
"I'm his son."
"Good."
Faskus lay back and closed his eyes for a moment. Ben thought the man might die then and there, but this was only a gesture of relief, and Faskus opened his eyes to look at his daughter.
"Guardsman Skywalker will take care of you from now on."
"No, Daddy."
Kiara hurled herself onto her father's chest.
"He hurt you."
"He just knocked me down. I was already hurt. The starfighter hurt me."
Uncomfortable with the exchange with what was coming, Ben interrupted.
"Why did you steal the amulet of Kalara?"
Faskus looked at him, confused.
"I didn't."
"Yes, you did. From an office building on Drua."
"Drua is where they gave it to me, yes. That's where I live and work.
I thought you were from Zyost.
Faskus shook his head, not an energetic move.
I'm from Almania. I'm a courier.
Who gave the amulet to you?
A Bothan named Dior. He told me to bring it here, to land at specific coordinates and carry the amulet to a nearby cave, to come alone.
He laughed, one short bark that ended in a gasp of pain.
I'm sorry, Kiara. I wish I had. I'm so sorry.
And you were strafed?
Ben asked. Faskus nodded.
I was partway to the cave when I heard the engine roar. I ran back to the Blacktooth. They were firing on it. A TIE fighter. Kiara was still inside. I had to reach her.
Ben didn't need to ask anything more. The rest of the story was clear to him. Faskus has gotten his daughter clear of the transport, but some calamity, an explosion perhaps, had sent a shard of Durasteel into his guts and killed him slowly.
Please.
His voice was weak, wavering.
Untie my hands so I can hold her.
Ben thought it over, then nodded. Using Faskus's own vibroblade, he cut the bonds on the man's hands. Then, while Kiara sobbed and Faskus spoke soothingly to her in ever quieter tones, Ben began to break down the man's camp and inventory his goods. Ben counted 6 oversized blankets, one of them slightly damaged by his lightsaber, several wooden poles being used as tent poles, 4 Durasteel spikes anchoring the tent to the ground, 3 blasters and a vibroblade, each one with extra power packs, food rations, possibly as much as a week's worth, a quantity of cord, the backpack, the contents of Faskus's pouch, including a data pad, numerous cred coins, cred cards, data cards, and identicards, and the man's clothes, if he wanted them. But he didn't. He carefully broke down the tent, exposing the girl and her father to the first snowfall of the day, and folded all the blankets, except the ones constituting the floor, on which Faskus and Kiara still lay. Faskus's eyes were still open, but he no longer spoke, and Ben could not feel him through the Force. The astromech came waddling down from its position of concealment as Ben began dividing all his new goods between his own pack and the larger backpack Faskus had made.
Good news, Shaker, Ben said. Several power packs. If you have adapters, we can keep you going for a long time. Yeah, Ben said. It's sad.
Even sadder was what he'd have to do in a minute. But his duty was clear. He had to get the amulet to Jason, and that meant not taking chances with his resources. He thought about asking Kiara to move so he could claim the final 2 blankets, but decided that such a request was unnecessary. 4 blankets would be enough for just him. He spent a few minutes using more cord to tie the big backpack to Shaker's dome, and then he began walking. He didn't hear Shaker following. He turned to see the R2 still in place. Its optic sensor glided back and forth, staring first at him, then at Kiara.
Come on, Shaker.
The astromech began waddling in his direction.
Hey!
Kiara sat up.
You can't go. Daddy said you were going to take care of us.
I'm sorry, Ben said. But I didn't say I would.
You can't leave him. The animals will eat him.
I'm sorry.
Turning his back on the girl a second time took an act of will, but recognition of his duty gave him the strength to do it. He began walking again slowly, and Shaker followed. Ben opened his data pad, and it had received Shaker's message.
What is our destination?
I had a look at Faskus's data pad.
Ben tapped his pouch to reassure himself that the pad was still there.
There's information on Zyost that I don't have, like the coordinates where he was supposed to set down, the cave where he was supposed to leave the amulet. I guess he abandoned that part of the plan after he got hurt. And a lot of locations marked ruins. I bet that wherever there are ruins, there's stuff to find. Maybe even people. Maybe even the base that TIE fighter is from. We're headed for the nearest ruin site. I bet Faskus was too.
Why are you leaving the girl behind?
That caused Ben's stomach to knot up again.
Because if she's with us, we'll go through our resources faster, like our food. and we might not get to where we need to go. Our mission is more important than her life.
Is the mission more important than your life too?
Ben thought about it for 50 meters of travel.
Yes.
Then tell me your mission, so that if you falter, I can abandon you and complete it.
Ben turned around and kicked the astromech in its dome. Shaker squawked and fell over, but the bindings Ben had used to lash the big backpack in place did not loosen.
Shut up, you walking hot plate! If you didn't have a few useful systems to go along with that malfunctioning droid brain of yours, I'd leave you too.
Shaker didn't offer a response. It didn't try to right itself. Ben forced himself to calm down. He'd wait until he was sure he didn't need the astromech anymore. Then he'd crush it in a vise or throw it out an upper story viewport. No, that made no sense. It was valuable property. He could sell it for passage to another planet if he could find someone willing to take him. With a sigh, he righted the astromech, then continued walking. An hour later, as they crossed a lightly forested ridgeline, Ben's datapad beeped, but Shaker hadn't made any noise indicating he was trying to communicate. Ben stopped and opened his datapad. Images of his parents swam into focus on its diminutive screen. They were both smiling.
Ben,
Mara said,
in case you hadn't noticed, you're 14.
Congratulations on another birthday, Luke said. So whatever torture your teachers, including me, had in store for you today, forget it. Report to me for some birthday credits, and the rest of the day is yours to enjoy.
Their images faded to blackness. Shaker came up behind Ben and waited with a droid's patience. Oddly, Ben felt as though there were nothing inside him, as if he had suddenly become a Ben-shaped balloon filled with gas. Gas could not think, and neither could he, for a long moment. They had to have recorded this shortly before he started this mission.
Hi, Mom,
he said.
Hi, Dad. For my 14th birthday, I killed a little girl.
He sat down, his lower back resting against the astromech. He leaned forward, wrapping his arms around his knees, and he began to cry. Kiara stabbed at the ground with the knife. It was an eating utensil, not a vibroblade, and when it hit the ground, it made a ringing noise. Sometimes it scraped away a little of the ice-hard soil, sometimes it didn't. After more than an hour of digging, punctuated by fits of sobbing, she had dug a hole a little larger than her hand. But she'd keep digging. Her father was dead, and she had to put him in the ground so the animals wouldn't come and eat him. Through the snowfall, she could see that there were booted feet in front of her. She looked up into the face of Ben Skywalker. The waddling astromech was entering the clearing from the far edge. Ben didn't say anything for a few moments. Then he took a look around.
I think we need to wrap him in one of the blankets, then pile rocks on top of him. That will keep the animals away.
They won't try to eat him?
They won't eat him. I'll wrap him up and find the rocks. You put the other blanket around you and go sit with Shaker.
Kiara did as she was told. Her tears didn't stop flowing, but now she knew her father would be safe under the rocks.
Coruscant.
The weeks after the military disaster at Corellia did not argue for a quick resolution to the conflict. Fondor, a world well known for its orbital shipyards, a world whose economy had been chafing under Galactic Alliance military production restrictions, announced its resignation from the Alliance and signed articles of friendship with Corellia and her allies. It was just one more world, increasing the size of the Confederation, no longer being referred to as the Corellian Confederation at the indignant insistence of Bothawe and Commodore, from 3 systems to 4. But of those 4 systems, 2, Corellia and Fondor, possessed ship construction yards that were critical to Alliance military development. Fondor's loss lit up the Holonews services. Soon after, Bespin, with its crucial production facilities for Tabana gas, and Adumar, with its munitions industry, also joined the Confederation. And other worlds were wavering. The worlds of Hutt Space made no secret of their preference for the Confederation, or of their willingness to remain staunch, warm friends of the Alliance, as long as they received special trade and aid privileges that would pour wealth into their accounts. Several planets of the Imperial Remnant, long uncomfortable with being part of the Alliance, suggested that they favor the Confederation, but the Moff Council continued to abide by its treaties with the Alliance. Grand Admiral Pellion recently retired and returned to the world of Bastion, participating in the ongoing process of rebuilding and repopulating the Imperial Throne World, spoke openly and often of the Empire's need to remain associated with the Alliance. During these weeks, there were only sporadic clashes between the Alliance and the Confederation. Admiral Limpan's task force at Corellia made frequent raids against the Corellian shipyards, the still-intact Centerpoint Station, and industrial facilities on the other worlds allied with Corellia, though these were largely inconclusive. The Confederation forces in the Bothawi system succeeded with minimal effort in driving Alliance observation vehicles into retreat. Neither side pressed an assault. The Confederation world sat back, tightened their defenses, sent diplomats with offers of friendship to scores of systems, and cranked up their ship production to epic levels. The Alliance brought military forces back from distant stations and patrols, gathered information, and enhanced security. Mostly the war was fought in the news feeds, with analysts predicting where the next major action would be fought, who would start it, and how it would end. Admiral Matrick Kloskin, recently vanished from a hospital on Coruscant, turned up on his homeworld of Kaminor. His handlers transmitted to Coruscant the resignation of his commission with the Galactic Alliance military. At a dinner on Kaminor, he was recognized as a hero of his planet and was ceremoniously retired. He was not observed to speak much during the celebration, and close observers described him as unresponsive and glassy-eyed.
Galactic Alliance Military Headquarters, Senior Officers' Briefing Room.
"The so-called Chasen document," said General Tycho Selchew, "is authentic."
A tall, elegantly handsome man with blonde hair frosting to white, he radiated confidence and competence. Admiral Nyathol was not concerned with what the human military analyst radiated. Her eyes vibrated with her agitation.
"It can't be, General. We had no plans to invade Kaminor."
"Yes, we did," Tycho assured her. 30 years ago, back when the Rebel Alliance was mounting its campaign for the liberation of crucial planetary systems of the Empire, General Garm Bell Iblis drew up a number of plans for individual systems. The Chasen document, recently obtained for us by intelligence, is a revision of Bell Iblis's Operation Blue Plug. Blue Plug was never launched because Kaminor voluntarily ousted its Imperial Governor a few months after Coruscant fell to us."
"Were the details of Operation Blue Plug ever made public?" Nyathol asked.
Tycho shook his head.
"No. They've been classified top secret for decades. Classified and forgotten, owing to their irrelevance. I wasn't aware of them. But when I began doing my analysis of the Chasen document, I was struck by how thoroughly it resembled General Bell Iblis's preferred logistical patterns. At first I thought it must have been drawn up by a student of the General's. But then it occurred to me that the plan made no provisions for the use of the most modern classes of ships, and that made me suspicious. So I went looking through the records."
"I see. And do we have any indication of how the original plan fell into the hands of someone who might revise it and pass it off to the Kaminorians?"
"Yes."
A touch of dismay was visible through Tycho's controlled manner.
"Our security has been compromised. An analysis of the databanks where that file was stored indicated that the only times it had been accessed in recent years was when automated backup programming refreshed it and compared it with static stored copies. Military programmers could find no other signs of intrusion. So I requested assistance from intelligence, which revealed the method used."
Murmurs from other active duty officers cut him off.
"By intelligence in this case," Nyathol said, "you mean your wife?"
"Yes."
Tycho's wife, Winter, was a longtime operative. She'd been a field agent back when the New Republic had been an ideal rather than a reality. She had helped rear the Alliance's most popular son, Jason Solo. Solo was one of the officers at the table, and he listened dispassionately, not reacting when Winter was mentioned. Tycho continued.
Rinter discovered that the backup code had been replaced. It was still doing its job, but it was additionally sending those files to an off-site location. Once we knew what to look for, we found similar programs backing up other banks of data. This programming was self-replicating and could have spread itself through the entire military network, but we caught it in time. It had accessed only older files and some ordnance inventories.
And your actions?
We scrubbed the malignant code and turned over pertinent details to military intelligence, Galactic Alliance intelligence, and the Galactic Alliance Guard.
Niathal nodded.
Do we know how our systems were violated?
In part, Tycho said. Verifiable records suggest that the initial code slicing took place during a routine data inquiry using a GAG passcode.
Ridiculous, Jason said.
Tycho regarded him steadily.
But verifiable.
No one with access at a high enough level to make significant requests of the military network is a security risk.
Jason kept his voice hard.
In addition to all the security measures we employ, I'm a Jedi. It would be next to impossible for one of my senior officers to deceive me that way.
Next to impossible, Tycho said, isn't impossible.
Give me the passcode, Jason snapped.
Reciting from memory, Tycho said,
379HOL44_B921.
Jason whipped out his datapad and accessed a file. He scrolled through it for a few moments. Then his expression went from merely angry to angry and confused.
Unassigned, he said, toward the bottom of the unassigned list.
I suggest,
Niathal said,
that you run checks on the other unassigned codes to be sure they haven't been used as well.
Jason snapped the datapad shut.
I'll do that.
And report your findings.
Yes, Admiral.
Clearly furious, Jason turned away and avoided eye contact.
Is there anything else?
Niathal asked.
Yes.
The speaker was a dark-skinned, dark-haired woman, dressed in somber civilian dress rather than in uniform. She was Belindi Kalenda, the Galactic Alliance's Director of Intelligence since the end of the Yuuzhan Vong War.
I have one item pertaining to the military. Information has reached me suggesting that the Confederation is experiencing growing pains and increased difficulty as more planets join with coordinating their respective military forces.
Niathal cocked her head at the director.
The only surprising part about that is that they haven't selected a Supreme Commander already.
Not the only surprising part, Admiral. What I'm hearing is that the Bothans have demanded that the Supreme Commander be elected at a face-to-face meeting of representatives from each world in the Confederation.
We have to be there, Jason said.
Niathal nodded.
Colonel Solo is correct. The delegations will include some of the Confederation's best military leaders and brightest minds, not to mention politicians who are very knowledgeable about their world's plans. If we can eliminate the attendees, we reduce the Confederation's planning abilities by a noticeable degree. If we can capture them, we stand to obtain a tremendous amount of critical knowledge. Director Kalenda, please bring a maximum effort to bear on obtaining that information. Don't hesitate to call on us for resources.
Understood, Admiral.
Coruscant, Jedi Temple Training Hall.
I think you're taking the whole Sword of the Jedi thing too seriously, Zek said.
In response, Jaina darted in, raising her lightsaber in a horizontal hold. She began a high, sweeping slash, visualizing her attack as she did so. But hers was a feint, and contrary to her visualization, she dipped the tip of the blade well beneath Zek's blocking maneuver and tagged him along his right ribs. The weapon made a zap noise. A practice saber, it gave Zek an electrical jolt instead of a new burn scar to match the one he'd earned not so long ago. He stepped back, rubbing where the blade had touched him.
Hey, you cheated.
Jaina nodded.
I relied on the fact that you anticipate me all the time, because you rely too often on anticipating me.
Maybe so.
And I'm not taking the Sword of the Jedi designation too seriously. How can I, when I don't even know what it means? Not even Uncle Luke really knows what it means. He's never been entirely sure why he said it. Maybe it was the Force speaking through him.
Zek readied his practice saber again. Maybe it means you're the new chosen one. Jaina shuddered, then went on guard again.
I hope not. It took my grandfather decades, multiple amputations, and a lot of tragedy to achieve his destiny. Besides, there's no emperor for me to hurl down a well.
There's Lumaya.
The voice came from several meters away. Jaina and Zek drew away from each other and looked toward the speaker. Jag Fel sat cross-legged on a practice mat, dressed in his usual black city garb. Jaina realized she hadn't seen or felt him enter.
I wish he wouldn't spy on us, Zek said.
Jaina deactivated her practice saber.
What about Lumaya?
Jag shrugged.
The Chosen One destroyed the leader of the Sith. Lumaya's Sith, correct?
Zek deactivated his own blade.
She's what's left of the Sith. I doubt that it will take someone who fills a once-in-a-generation prophetic role, if that's what the sword is, to eliminate her.
I'll admit, I don't have enough knowledge of the Jedi even to speculate in an informed manner.
Good for you.
Jag grinned as though Zek's words were humor rather than insolence. Then he continued.
But I look at it this way. A sword is a weapon. A weapon of the Jedi would be used by the will of, or against the enemy of, the Jedi. The enemy of the Jedi are the Sith, and other anti-Jedi, whatever they choose to call themselves. The sword of the Jedi would therefore be someone who is wielded against the Sith. So is that simple, simplistic, or just wrong?
I vote for simplistic. Zek returned his attention to Jaina. Another round?
Jaina shook her head.
I want to hear this. I've never really gotten the perspective of someone outside the Order, and Jag always has an interesting perspective.
Zek sighed, long-suffering, and reached out a hand. Jaina passed her practice saber to him. Zek dutifully headed toward the rack where practice weapons were stored. Jag began beeping. Rather, some electronic device on his person did. Looking startled, Jag pulled his datapad from a pocket.
High-priority flash traffic.
He opened the device, read a few lines, and then began reading aloud.
From the central computer of the Errant Venture, Jedi Temple Holocam recognition and analysis code assigns 94% probability of match to target Aleem Arar for attached sequence.
Jag stood so fast he could have been yanked to his feet by invisible springs.
Hunt's on.
Expressionless, he ran toward the training hall's exit.
Coruscant Space, Errant Venture.
Walking, half staggering, because the great gambling ship's artificial gravity generator seemed to be phasing on and off, right and left, and had been doing so since she downed her sixth whiskey of the evening, Captain Uran Levint turned a corner into the narrow passageway where her cabin was located. The thought of returning to her cabin drew a sigh from her. There was an even odds chance that Aleema would be there, skulking, ready to discuss her day's worth of spying failures, ready to offer another set of threats. But now, as she weaved her way to her door, a shadow seemed to flow off the opposite wall of the passageway and stand over her. Levint reached for her holdout blaster and was bringing it in line to fire, or at least threaten, when the stranger snatched it from her hand. He didn't aim it back at her. He just held it, barrel down. Levint peered at him, alarmed and suspicious, for the seconds it took to bring his face into focus. Then she recognized him and laughed.
Colonel Solo, she said. Here to kill me?
He shook his head and handed her the blaster. No, I need you. She replaced the blaster in its hideaway holster on her third try, then drew her datapad from its pocket and used it to open the cabin door. Beyond was a small chamber, minimal furniture, and no Aleema, unless she was under the bed or up in the ceiling somewhere. Levint led her visitor in and immediately sat on the chamber's one chair, leaving Jason to decide whether to take the bed or stand. He elected to stand. I have need of your services. There's going to be a gathering of Confederation warships in a few days, from different systems.
Their leaders will meet, they'll elect a joint leader, and they'll launch against a common target. I need to be at that meeting site to find out who's there, who's a conspirator.
I won't do it. You can't be trusted. You sabotage hyperdrives.
A flash of anger crossed his face. Your hyperdrive did fail.
Of course it did. And I spent several long, long hours thinking I was going to die alone in space.
Whatever price we agree to, I'll deliver fully in advance to you or your agent of choice, irretrievably.
All right.
Levint didn't have to think for long.
I want the breathe my jets back.
I can't do that within our time frame. It's been overhauled, recommissioned, put into service as a GA transport. It would take weeks or months to detach it from service, bring it here, and work the ownership records. He thought about it for a moment. How about a Gallo-Free Yards medium transport, 12 years old, seized from Corellia, freshly reconditioned and repaired at the Coruscant Yards, but not yet assigned? I can claim it for GAG and divert it to you, ownership free and clear.
I agree, assuming it's been fully fueled, armed, provisioned, and not sabotaged.
Understood. What else?
I'm going to need to lay some credits around to buy the information you need. 15, 20,000.
Done.
And I want you to get a message to your parents for me.
What?
You can do that, can't you?
What message?
I want them to send me away, anyway to reach them, at my leisure. Just for one transmission.
He considered, then said, "All right, I'll find a way." She smiled at him.
"That's it."
Zai asked.
Every morning, Ben awoke with the memory of the voices in his ears. Some part of his mind tried to listen to them, to puzzle out what they were saying. The rest of him worked harder to avoid comprehending. He knew, deep down, that if he listened long enough to understand, he'd want to do what they told him, and that what they told him would be very, very wrong. So sleep was not restful for Ben. Even on the nights when his fire burned through all the darkness hours and Kiara huddled against him, sad but trusting. During those nights, he often awoke to a sense of worry or a beep from Shaker to see eyes gleaming from the other side of the fire. Nocturnal predators, Jason would have called them, and Ben could feel them in the Force. They were big, powerful presences there, suffused with energy and wrongness. He could feel that they were as twisted as the blighted trees of this place. So far they hadn't attacked, but Ben made sure that Kiara was never more than a step or two from him, except when either of them needed to perform some private business in the trees. There was another presence, too. The day after Ben found Kiara, at about noon, they had stopped for a quick meal of canned rations. Ben sat consuming some grease-packed meat product and eating quickly so that he wouldn't taste the stuff. Wary of the wild beasts he still had not seen, he had his physical and Force awareness stretched to their limits, and abruptly he was certain that someone was looking at him. He stood, looking around, and grabbed his lightsaber. But nothing approached. And after a few moments, the sensation faded. The next day, again, at planetary noon, it happened once more, this time as they reached the remains of what must have been once a road. Once more, after less than a minute, the sensation faded. The next day at noon, he was waiting for the sensation, and it did not fail him. In the few seconds he had, he sought the viewer through the Force, and he was successful. Whoever was staring at him was doing so from straight up. Ben peered up through the canopy of leafless branches, but there was nothing for him to see. Just the sun gleaming dimly through a layer of clouds. He said,
"Shaker, passive sensors only. Look straight up."
Again, the sensation faded. Ben pulled out his data pad.
"Did you see anything?"
"I detect a faint ion trail."
"The ion trail? The kind that a TIE fighter would leave?"
"Correct."
So the person who had blown up both the YT-2400 and the Y-Wing was shadowing them. But why? And just as importantly, how?
Star system MZX-32905 near Bamil.
The hologram of the scrawny, bronze-hued Bothan flickered and jittered. Lumaya pretended not to notice. She'd chosen Dior and crew in part because their ship had a holocom, but it clearly wasn't a very good one.
"Right on time," she said,
forcing a note of commendation into her voice.
"What do you have to report?"
"Vasquez is dead,"
Dior said.
"The boy and the astromech appear to be heading toward one of the old settlements, and there is a complication."
"Go ahead."
"It looks as though Vasquez took his little girl along. She's still alive. The boy has taken her with him."
Lumaya sat back and considered. That was unfortunate. The order she had meticulously structured with Jason didn't specify what Ben should do in such a case. And while rescuing a little girl might initially give him a warm feeling of satisfaction, continuing to protect her had to be a considerable drain on his attention and energies. Taking her along was not survival thinking, not mission success thinking, not Sith thinking. And the boy must know it. He was just too much like his father. And that meant he'd never be good Sith material.
"Kill them,"
she said.
"Consider it done."
Zyost.
The next day at mid-morning, they found the first location marked ruins on Vasquez's map. It was a mass of collapsed stone, dressed stone blocks that had once formed the wall of a small citadel before some tremendous force had pushed them over. Ben found weathering on all exposed surfaces of the stones, but no sign of blaster scoring, melting, or other recognizable indicators of violence. And he found no way into the mass. Neither his eyes nor his force senses suggested a place he might enter to find intact chambers, nor did Shaker sensors.
"We'll rest and eat here," he said. "Shaker, set up to detect ion trails and communications, please."
And fewer than 10 minutes later, just as Ben was finishing a chilled can of Nerf steak stew, Ben pulled out his datapad and read.
"You just sent a comm signal."
Ben scowled.
"I did? Of less than 1/100th of a second's duration. Was there a return signal?"
"No." Ben glanced at the time in the corner of the datapad screen. There were two listings there, one local and one Coruscant, and the local time was exactly one standard hour short of noon. Quickly, he unpacked everything from both backpacks, segregating the items into two stacks, everything he had examined before and everything he hadn't. He attacked the second pile, minutely scrutinizing each item. He methodically checked all the other items too, to the point of shaking out his belt pouch over the pile of goods to make sure it was empty. It wasn't. Nothing more fell out, but the bottom of the pouch sagged oddly in his hand. The pouch seemed to weigh more than it should, if only fractionally. He turned the pouch inside out and found the tracking device. It looked like a small steel marble, albeit one with spindly spider legs that were threaded into the cloth of the pouch, holding it securely in place. One leg stretched to a length of 6 or 7 centimeters. Ben stared at it, perplexed. When had this been planted on him? Or more to the point, since it looked like a mobile unit, when had it crawled into his pouch? Then he felt the eyes in the sky again. He checked his datapad. High noon, exactly. Except this time, the sensation of being watched did not fade after a few seconds. It intensified. And Ben could feel something with it, emotions of wicked amusement, a desire to commit mayhem. He glanced up. There was a tiny dot up in the sky, in the center of the cloud cover blocking the worst of the sun's rays from reaching the ground.
"Shaker,"
he said,
"get under cover."
Kiara, who had been disinterestedly finishing her can of spice loaf sausages, looked up. She hadn't said much in the last few days, and didn't say anything now, but she hopped up as Ben reached her. That was when the first streaks of laser fire scorched the ground. Green bolts strafed the stand of stones a few meters to Ben's right. Kiara shrilled a scream. Ben caught her up and leapt leftward toward the near line of trees, 60 or more meters away.
The TIE fighter screamed past and began to loop around for another strafing run. He stopped. If he continued toward the trees, he'd be caught out in the open for the next pass. He reversed direction and ran toward the mound of stones. It offered the only protection close enough to reach. He leapt behind a partially intact stand of rocks and peeked over. The TIE fighter was low, barely 50 meters above ground, and coming straight at them. Ben ducked down again as the TIE fired. Ben glanced down at Kiara. She was huddled against the ground, against the stone surface she lay on, rather, and her face was turned upward, her eyes full of fear. He looked around for a missile, then realized he was surrounded by them. He closed his eyes and concentrated. He heard Kiara's gasp as the stone that had just fallen over rose a few centimeters into the air. The TIE fighter came on. Ben couldn't so much sense it as he could sense the pilot at the heart of its ball-shaped cockpit. He felt the stone, he felt the pilot, and he tried to send one to the other. Sluggishly, the stone rose into the path of the TIE fighter. Ben heard the scream of lasers firing again and opened his eyes in time to see one green bolt hitting the wall far to his left, the other hitting the floating stone dead center, shattering it into 1,000 shards. The TIE fighter veered but could not get entirely clear of the cloud of debris. Ben heard the high-pitched clunks and pings as the left solar array wing hit the shards. The TIE fighter suddenly gained a lot of altitude, circled once, and then climbed again until it was out of sight. Ben looked down at Kiara again.
"We're fine, for now," he said. "The bad man went away."
She nodded, half believing.
"No, really."
He paused, trying to think of what to say to convince her. Then he leaned down and embraced her, felt her shaking.
"It's all right. It's all right."
Her reply was muffled.
"Will he come back?"
"Yes, he will. But next time, I'll be ready for him."
Gendine System, Tendrando Refueling and Repair Station, cockpit of the Millennium Falcon.
Han finished the pre-flight checkup. Lando's repair workers appeared to have done a great job. Han flexed his left shoulder experimentally. It felt good. He was healed. Everything was fixed, but nothing was tested. He forced a crooked smile for Leia, who was once more in the co-pilot's seat.
"Ready to go, sweetheart?"
She finished strapping in.
"Ready."
"Lando!"
From behind him in the navigator's seat came Lando's voice.
"Oh, I suppose it just won't be the same not being able to order you around. Leia, remind me to get the navigator seat rigged with an ejector option."
Han heeled over, putting the stars to starboard and the night side of Gendine to port, and despite his words, began a slow, smooth acceleration into a sample high orbit. The engines sounded sweeter than they had in quite a while. Gendine's sun came into view, no longer eclipsed by the planet, and the cockpit viewports polarized dramatically, making vision useless. Sensors showed the main cluster of the planet's orbital shipyards, far less numerous than those of Kuat or Corellia, but well-respected, at a lower orbit. They were passing directly above those shipyards when the enemy task force appeared. The Falcon's threat sensors howled as a tremendous mass appeared directly in her flight path. Han hauled back on the yoke, a hard maneuver that pressed him and his crew deep into their seats, and cringed as he heard something scrape on the Falcon's underside.
"Shields. We grazed her shields," Leia muttered.
Their new course wasn't much better. The Falcon flashed through a squadron of starfighters at right angles to their course, too fast for Han to have anything but a vague impression of them.
"Shields up!" Han shouted. "What the bricks is going on?"
Leia remained cool. "Sensors say it's a Bothan assault cruiser and 6 squadrons of Howl runners." And the squadron Han had flown through was turning into the Falcon's wake. The capital ship gunners, doubtless caught unawares by the proximity of the Falcon when they arrived, now begin firing turbo laser batteries. Han sent the Falcon into a dizzying spiral of evasive maneuvering.
"Sweetheart, Lando, I hate to ask."
Leia unbuckled.
"Yes, we'll go shoot down the bad furry people for you."
Then she and Lando were gone. The first shots from the pursuing Howl runners battered at his rear shields, and Han growled.
"3PO!" he shouted. "Get up here! Operate the sensors and comm board!"
"Yes, Captain Solo."
the protocol droid, rocking wildly back and forth as Han's maneuvers nearly took him from his feet, managed to slide into the seat Leia had vacated. Very prudently, he strapped himself in.
If I may ask, sir...
Don't!
Han rolled 90 degrees to starboard and arced around to a course straight out from the planet.
What's happening, sir?
Bothans have sent a task force to destroy or capture the shipyards here. They must have jumped straight at Jindyne and let the planet's gravity well yank them out of hyperspace. That's why they appeared so close.
Your pursuers are 10 in number. No, 9. Someone appears to have scored a hit, and one of them is heading in a different direction.
Distantly, Han could hear Lando's shout of nice shooting. He grinned. That was his lady, always blowing up people who intended to cause him grief.
And you're getting a message.
From the Bothan ship demanding surrender?
Well, no, actually. It's from a Captain Uron Levent.
Han grimaced.
Tell her I can't talk right now.
Oh, it's not live. It's recorded. I'm saving it both to the Falcon's computer and to my own memory. I believe in redundancy.
Han sent the Falcon into another series of jinking-junking moves. The hammering his rear shields was taking lessened, but he could see the protocol droid's head whipping back and forth on his metal neck.
Sir, Master Lando requests a little more stability.
Does he?
Well, that's what I interpret from the rather florid language he's employing. 6 pursuers, 2 damaged, 2 destroyed. I see. The rest are breaking off. Oh!
While they were in hyperspace, Han reviewed the message Levent had sent him. Then he put it on one of the large displays for everyone to see. It seemed to have been recorded by the cheapest variety of pocket holocam. The image of the woman's leathery face, when stretched to fill the large display, was heavily pixelated.
Greetings. I'm sending you this message to do you a big favor and hope you'll do me one in return.
Smuggler economics, Leia whispered.
I'm on the errant venture under my own name. There's someone else here, too. A Twi'lek by the name of Alima Rar.
Han glanced at Leia, her face set into hard lines.
I think she has plans for you, and I don't think they're nice ones. So I'm sending you this message. I'm betting that she'll kill me, too, when I'm of no more use to her. So I'm hoping you'll do her first. She says she's a Jedi, otherwise I'd try myself. But in my experience, it doesn't pay to try to knock off a Jedi. And I have a favor to ask. There are rumors that there's an important meeting planned of Confederation bigwigs. For personal reasons, I really need to get somebody there. I don't know what your affiliations are, and I don't care, but I don't plan to do anything to disrupt the meeting. You're one of the best connected people in the galaxy. If you could let me know where and when, I'd appreciate it. Please erase this message once you've reviewed it. A bunch of people would kill me if they knew I sent it.
The message ended, fading to black.
Huh,
Han said. He glanced at Leia.
What do you think?
Hard to tell with a low-resolution message, Leia said. I'd need to speak to her in person to get a real sense of whether she's telling the truth. But her story makes sense. That would explain the presence I felt aboard Errant Venture. After our last talk with Luke, I've been wondering if it might have been Alima or Lumaya. Han nodded.
Let's go back to the Errant Venture.
Lando sounded hurt.
You're not asking my opinion?
Han sighed.
Lando, should we go back to the galaxy's largest mobile gambling and shopping enterprise? What kind of a stupid question is that?
Zyost.
Ben dreamed of red eyes springing across the fire he had built. And the dream was so powerful, so immediate, that he woke up out of it in mid-kick. His foot connected with something muscular. His blow deflected it in the air, but Ben took enough of the force of the impact that he was rolled backward away from his blanket. Shaker was tweedling sounds of alarm. Ben could see the droid's lights, dim glows where the fire was dying. Nothing else. There was darkness all around. He grabbed his lightsaber from his belt and activated it, casting a soft blue glow on his surroundings. Kiara was still wrapped up in her blankets, just now coming awake, her eyes wide. 2 meters beyond, between her and the nearest tree, a shape struggled back to its feet and whipped around to face Ben. It was extremely broad in the chest, with 4 stubby legs that ended in 3-toed feet. Its neck was protected by a bony plate or ridge that circled it like a collar. And its head was dominated by a long jaw filled with triangular pointed teeth. It looked a lot like Hollow's been had seen of necks, but there were no cybernetic enhancements to be seen, and this example was covered in short gray fur. The fur did not make it look like a plush toy. It crouched and roared at Ben, a roar that echoed from several directions outside the light cast by the lightsaber. When it roared, Kiara turned involuntarily to look. The creature glanced over, and instead of jumping for Ben, lunged at her. Ben jolted forward, but his reflexes were dulled by sleep and exhaustion. He could not reach her in time. Shaker's protruding arc welder arm touched the neck's side. There was a flash of light, and the beast howled. It twisted, biting Shaker, and took the droid's extended arm off with a snap of its jaws. And then Ben reached it. With a hard, downward stroke of his lightsaber, he cut through the neck's armor and into its neck. He only sliced halfway through, but that was enough to sever the spine. The beast collapsed, leaving others out there in the dark, close. He could hear them moving, hear their little growls and yips. They were communicating. Ben's initial flush of anger began to fade, and he started to think. He reached out through the Force, looking for his enemies. He found them, six in all, circling. Left-handed, he drew Faskus's blaster, aiming through the Force. He fired. There was a howl of pain out in the darkness, and he could both hear and detect through the Force the wounded neck bounding away. He chose another target, not bothering even to look in that direction, and fired a second time. The result was the same. One animal wounded and fleeing. The rest turned and faded away into the surrounding forest.
"Are they gone?"
Kiara asked. Ben holstered the blaster, drew his glow rod from his pouch, and switched it on and the lightsaber off at the same moment.
"Yeah, but we're going to spend the rest of the night up in the tree to be sure."
Minutes later, once he and Kiara were nestled together up in the tree, high enough, he hoped, that the necks could not reach them, Ben had time to think again. He wouldn't have been so oblivious to the necks' arrival, but he had been deep in sleep. He was getting more tired every day, and not sleeping as lightly as he used to, as lightly as a Jedi or an Alliance guard needed to. And he'd been dreaming. In the dream, the voices that pressed close all around had finally learned his name.
Ben. Ben.
Coruscant System, Errant Venture.
This time, there was a kind of electricity to the conversation, as if everyone involved knew they were steps closer to their goal. The interesting thing, Wedge noted, was that there were so many goals, but everyone was making progress.
"So Lando and I have been cashing in old favors," Han was saying. "Sometimes very old. And it turns out Captain Levin is right. There's a major Confederation gathering being put together. And it's not just to elect their warlord. News trickling out of that whole mess suggests they're assembling a fleet at the election spot. And from there, the new warlord will lead some sort of fleet action. But no one knows where or against what."
"Shipyards."
Wedge and Jag said the word at the same time and looked at each other.
"Kuat, Coruscant," Wedge began. "Sluisvan, Thyfera, any number of places, but shipyards," Jag said.
Zek frowned.
"How do you know?"
Wedge had noticed that Zek frowned just about every time Jag spoke, and Jag frowned just about every time Zek spoke.
"The pattern of the last several days' worth of Confederation attacks and raids," Wedge said. "Mostly against orbital shipbuilding facilities. Their clear strategy is to diminish the Alliance's production and repair of warships. That way, despite the fact that the Confederation has fewer worlds than the Alliance, by orders of magnitude, they'll come closer to parity in shipbuilding resources."
"Which sounds," Jag interrupted, "as though they have a pretty clear military plan in place. I wonder why they need a supreme military commander if they're already cooperating so well."
"That cooperation won't last without a commander they all agree on," Leia said.
"Now, back to Alima."
Wedge smiled.
"Sorry."
Jaina turned her tabletop display so everyone could see it. On it was the triangular plan of one entire Star Destroyer's deck level.
We've added the last several days' worth of Errant Venture security recordings to our sample, and Booster authorized the ship's computers to give their analysis top priority, and gave us a more complete set of deck plans to compare them with. We can confirm a pattern of Alima's movements. She began tapping the screen, and each time she did so, a different level was displayed. Here, for example, casinos and shopping. Thin traces widely spread. She was searching and not finding anything. She tapped again. A few casinos where she spent a lot of time. I don't think she's a gambler or attempting to build a new social life. Levin shows up a lot in the holocam views during Alima's presence, so it's likely she's keeping tabs on her partner. Alima was thrilled. Only half an hour ago, she detected the Force presence, the one that said Leia was probably aboard again.
"You were right," she told Levint.
She donned her black hooded cloak and felt around with her one functioning hand to be sure that all her weapons and tools were readily available.
"I usually am," Levint said.
She got up from the bed, moved to the compartment's tiny closet, and selected a dress jacket that was all piratical purple synth silk and big gold-toned buttons.
"I think I'll get some gambling in while you're out killing people. Hey, the deal is still the deal, right? You set eyes on either of the Solos, and I've met the terms of our contract."
"Of course,"
Alima assured her.
Zyost.
"Ben, save girl. Ben, protect girl."
I have to get her off world,"
Ben murmured in his sleep.
I need a ship."
"Ship. Ben, ship. Learn ship. Ben, learn ship."
I already know how to pilot a ship,"
Ben protested. He struggled against the hold sleep had on him, but something reminded him he mustn't move right now. If he moved, he would... what? Fall down.
"Learn ship."
The voice was unusually emphatic, and in Ben's mind, a picture appeared. The image of a ball-shaped craft. It was odd and organic, with a rough red surface texture. In the center of the sphere facing him was a transparent hatch or canopy. Red spars stretched upward and downward from the craft. They seemed articulated, insectile. But this vehicle was no living thing, not like a Yuuzhan Vong craft. Ben sensed it was machinery, but machinery that was aware of him, waiting for him. He woke up with sunlight, broken up by branches above, streaming into his face. And he knew where the red ship was. Or rather, he knew the direction to take to find it, if it was real. The TIE fighter did not find them at noon. That was because Ben snipped the long leg of the tracking device in his pouch, assuming that it was the unit's antenna. He must have been right. Starting an hour and a half beforehand and waiting until some time past noon, he, Kiara, and Shaker rested in a small ravine, a place where infrared traces would be harder to detect from any angle but straight up. He distantly felt the eye in the sky, but it did not come near him. If he ever needed to, he could reattach the antenna.
Coruscant System, Errant Venture.
In one of the ship's great lobbies, where lights were bright and visitors mingled well away from the expensive attractions of casinos and shops, but not far from the expensive attractions of several surrounding bars, Alima spent a few minutes in a data kiosk, downloading the last several lists of new arrivals. Of course, not everyone who came to Errant Venture consented to be listed, but many did, so that an automated search code would detect their names and announce their arrival to friends. She had scanned through several hundred names, recognizing none, when she felt a flicker in the Force. Then it was more than a flicker. It was a light, a signal. She looked toward its source. Entering the grand lobby was a human male, unusually tall, light-skinned, his long black hair tied back in a ponytail. He wore dressy civilian clothes, black slacks and boots, a dark blue tunic with yellow striping angled across the chest, a black vest and belt. Alima knew him at once.
He had once been a joiner, had once belonged to a Killick nest. He was Zek. She drifted toward him when she became aware of another presence, this one much closer. She turned her head to see a thick-chested man with a trim, graying beard and startling green eyes. He stood 2 meters from her, staring at her, smiling. He wore Jedi robes.
Horn,
she said.
I'll say this once, Corrin said. Give up now.
She raised her blowgun and fired. Horn plucked the dart from the air. He opened a datapad, dropped the dart onto the screen, and snapped the device closed. That gave Alima time to ignite her lightsaber. Corrin drew and followed suit, his silver blade contrasting sharply with her blue-black blade. Alima became aware of applause. Corrin, too, glanced around, not moving his head. Patrons of the errant venture were drawing back from their standoff, but not very far. Many were clapping. Some were putting down bets. Alima saw Corrin silently offer a curse at their stupidity. And now Zek was moving toward the two of them, his lightsaber held in hand. This was a trap, and Alima cursed her own stupidity. Alima turned and ran as fast as her crippled foot and damaged body could manage. Alima reached the exit and whipped around the corner, pausing for a moment to retrieve her blowgun from under her left arm and reload it. The broad corridor where she found herself was well lit, and the panic from inside the lobby had not yet infected the streams of pedestrian traffic here. So she was quick to notice the figure in the distance ahead of her, running toward her with unusual speed and purpose. It was Leia. Leia Solo, looking straight at her. Alima could feel a flash of anger from her through the Force. It was echoed by a similar flash from behind, down the hallway, in another direction. Alima grimaced. This wasn't right. Han should be here. Alima would kill Han. Leia would suffer. Alima would escape. But now, with 2 Jedi behind her and 1 in either escape direction, Alima would have to be instantly, lethally efficient if she was to get away. Getting away was the most important thing at this moment. She would have to abandon justice in favor of practicality. She would have to kill Leia. Alima raised her blowgun to her lips. Leia raised one hand. Alima felt the blowgun twitch, and the dart within it shot backward, straight into her mouth. Alima froze there for 1 long, terrible moment. But she wasn't dead. The poisoned tip had not come down on her tongue. With infinite care, Alima turned her head to one side and spat the dart out. Then, as cold fear clawed at her heart, she ran.